Hey, folks. Glad you're able to check out the podcast. Before we get to my guest, just want to give you an update what's going on with me. I still have the COVID, tired from it. I'm eating and sleeping and then sleeping and eating. And I'm sleeping alone. My wife's in another room. So that's an upside. And I'm trying to do some stuff around the house, and I'm getting frustrated because where I live, my driveway is in between two houses. And on the left side of my property, the neighbor has like three bird feeders. And then on the right side, this guy has like nine bird feeders. And the birds, we have no bird feeders. So the birds fly from the property next to me to the other property next to me over my house and property because they know that's where the food is. Well, you know, if you're a bird, you're like a person, you eat, you got to relieve yourself so you can eat more. So they take a dump right over my property all the time, a lot of them. So my car is constantly pelted with bird shit and I can't stand it. I hate birds. This is ridiculous. It's like They're doing a strafing run like the Japanese did at Pearl Harbor. Let me tell you something. If they had birds at Pearl Harbor instead of Japanese airplanes, we'd all be speaking bird right now. All right, my guest this week, Alan Zweibel, a friend, brilliant comedy writer, one of the pillars of comedy, has been involved in SNL. One of the original writers for that, co-created It's Gary Shandling Show, which is a brilliant show, and works closely with Billy Crystal, has a movie coming out. It's Curb Your Enthusiasm, you name it. If it's a major comedy, he's been involved in it. So really cool conversation with him, his book, the stories from his life and what it's been like, his process of writing. I think you're really going to enjoy it. Okay, and avoid birds at any cost. Very excited to have a legend, and I don't mean that in a way that he's just old or anything, just a really legendary comedy writer. And I always get weird about that word. I don't want people to feel like, oh, whatever. It's just, he's one of the pillars of comedy in America, and was one of the first writers, original writers for SNL. He had a really very close relationship with Gilda Radner and worked with all the Not Ready for Primetime players, John Belushi, et cetera, co-created and produced amazing show is Gary Shandling Show, which is so still cutting edge and collaborates a lot with his lifelong friend Billy Crystal. They did the Tony Award winning show 700 Sundays together. They have a movie coming out together, which we'll talk about a little bit. And he has a great new book, a new book in audio, but it's been out. Laugh Lines: My Life Helping Funny People Be Funnier. It's Alan Zweibel. Great to have you, Alan.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Paul. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Also, I just want to mention real quick, you're going to be doing a virtual conversation event with Judd Apatow at the Stryker Center in New York City on August 6th. And you've got a video out with your musical group, Rock Bottom Remainders, which is really, really funny. And it's, sort of apropos for COVID, and it's a play on Stand By Me, and people need to go see it. And it's an amazing group of people in this band. It's you, Scott Turow, John Grisham, Dave Barry, Roger McGuinn is playing guitar, Mitch Albom. And is this a group of writers and creator artists that sort of you've done other collaborations with? Or is this the first time?
How I got to it was this is a group that started about 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And you're right. You know, people who are in it are Dave Barry and Stephen King and Amy Tan and Mitch Albom and Scott Turow and Mary Carr, all these, John Grisham and Carl Hyacin, all these great best-selling authors. And they appear primarily at book fairs, but they also were at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame one year and all of that. And I've been writing with Dave Barry for the last number of years. And a few years ago, he asked me if I wanted to be in the band. And I said, God, that would be great. But I don't know how to play an instrument and I can't sing. He said, oh, you're going to be perfect. So I sing background and it's such a kick. And it's all these great authors doing something other than writing together. And it's comparable in my mind to, you know, and when we go to different cities, if there's a legitimate musician there, Roger McGuinn from the Byrds, plays with us all the time.
Yeah.
And Springsteen has come on stage, you know, but it's comparable in my mind, Paul, to where for years, when Gary Shandling was alive, he would have these Sunday basketball games. All right.
I heard about these. You would be at those games, huh?
Oh, I played in those games for years. And whoever, whether it's Ben Stiller, you know, or Judd, Franken, you know, whoever was around played in those games. Sarah Silverman was a star, you know, really good basketball player. And that's how I met Sarah. So, and there it was, funny people doing something that wasn't, it was about something else. It was playing basketball.
Yeah.
It was just fun. And the rock bottom remained is this group. It's the same exact thing. It started years before I joined them, and I'm thrilled to be in their company.
Oh, it's really great. Everyone needs to go see it. It's on YouTube. It's funny, you know, those basketball games, I heard about them. They're stuff of legend. Why do you think that was important for Gary and all of you to bond in that way? You obviously all, in some way, shape, or form, were working together closely like you and he were, or crossing paths a lot in the comedy community. But why do you think that week, that Sunday event was important or mattered to people?
Because it wasn't about work.
Yeah.
It didn't have the pressure of coming up with lines or you know, dialogue or plot points. It was just like for a couple of hours, you were airing yourself out and we were playing basketball. Mm. It was just about our diminished skills as older people. What I mean, you know, it's in my book. I mean, Judd Apatow, he said, I don't remember this. He said, but I dislocated his shoulder. I was a terrible basketball player. So I would take my girth, you know what I mean? And just sort of bully people under, you know, for rebounds. Franken says I broke his thumb. I sort of remember that because I drove him to the hospital. And if I remember back, you know, well, why did I drive him to the hospital? I must have done something terrible to him, okay? But Judge says, to this day, every time he puts on his shirt, he thinks of me. And so I imagine he thinks about me a lot, given, you know, that we wear different shirts all the time. So it was not about anything that taxed your brain.
Hmm.
It was not trying to make an impression. I got to come up with something funny. There was no pressure. It was just playtime.
Yeah, that's great. You're like the Rick Mahorn from the Detroit Pistons. You were the punisher that went in and sort of punished people under the rim. Is that right?
There was a little Bill Laimbeer in there. There was if you want, we want to pick on the Pistons. Yeah, I think I was the annihilator. You know what I mean? I made up for my lack of skills with. I'll get that rebound. I don't give a damn who's in front of me.
Well, you know, the book is really wonderful. I've read it, and it's so good because it's so personal. It's funny. It's touching. It's not an outsider analyzing the business, but somebody from the inside, but not just from the inside, but at these critical, pivotal moments in the comedy world over the last 30, 40 years. And, you know, you transitioned. It's funny because you reminded me of me a little bit. You know, you sold your first joke for $7 to a Porsche Belt comedian. My first joke I sold to Jay Leno when I was still working on Wall Street and had this idea of writing comedy. And but then you transitioned after working for the Porsche Belt comedians. And there's a quote you have, which is pretty interesting. You said, I had an affinity for words and wordplay. And when I got George Carlin's album Class Clown, I decided I want to be the writer version of Carlin. He and the new wave of comedians were speaking more to me. How so were they speaking to you coming out of that experience with the Borscht Belt comedians?
Well, you just by virtue of age and life experience, I mean, I was out of college, I was 21, 22. These guys were 45 and 50. So it was like writing jokes that would make my parents' generation laugh.
Right.
Okay, so it was a real kick to hear an audience laugh at jokes that I wrote, but it wasn't my life experience. At the time, you know, Nixon had just resigned, No, he hadn't resigned yet. This was 72. But it was in the middle of Watergate. A few years earlier was Woodstock. The war was going on, the Vietnam War. And I wanted to, my life experience and my sensibility was as a child of those older guys. Growing up on Long Island, Alan King, the comedian, he was the conscience of and a spokesman for my parents' generation. Mm. He was this very successful comedian in a tuxedo with a cigar and a glass of whiskey or whatever it was on stage. And here we came along, and we were satirizing that generation. Mm. It was our turn to talk. So I got frustrated with the Borscht Belt guys, and I took the jokes they wouldn't buy from me, and I put them all together in a binder, and I delivered them myself and for 4 months. And then I was submitted to Lorne Michaels. He looked at the jokes, and he gave me a job on this new show that was going to premiere in the fall called Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. So that's how the transition was made. But it was it's a great question you just asked. The motivation was, you know, I wanted to write what I felt and what I knew, and I didn't feel it for those guys up in the Catskills.
Yeah, and you got to feel it. You know, I in writing on The Daily Show for Kilborn and then with Liz Winstead at the time and then Jon Stewart, you know, it's for friends that aren't in this business say, oh, you know, you just come up with an idea and you give it to somebody and it's funny. It's like, no, you have to not, you have to write in their voice. You have to stop and say, would this person say this? Was it hard to shed the rhythm and the sensibility of writing for a Freddie Roman and then make that shift to Carlin? Because you really have to make a pivot there. Or was that just sort of natural to you because you were closer in age to these guys, these younger guys?
Well, yeah, it was the second one. It was actually easier because when I got to SNL and I saw Gilda and Belushi and Aykroyd creating and Lorraine Newman creating characters in front of me, okay, right there, improvising, and they had distinct voices. Mm. It was easier to write for those voices because you know who they were. Mm. And then, you know, once they became characters, they dressed a certain way. You know what I mean? They looked a certain way. And so those rhythms were easier to capture. Whereas the Freddie Romans of the world, and he's a great, great commercial comedian. All of those guys up in the Catskill Mountains at that time, for the most part, were just joke tellers. Mm. So the joke had to work in and of itself. There was no nuance. There's not necessarily any personality with it. Mm. You know what I mean? Whereas if you had somebody like Belushi, you go, you'd write something and you go, all right, John will probably raise his eyebrow here and get a laugh that I don't, that I can't get with my words. You know what I mean? So there's a collaboration there and it was easier to capture.
How was, the relationships that you build creatively on SNL in terms of like, okay, so I know you and Gilda had this incredible bond and you guys did Bunny Bunny and you wrote with John, as you mentioned. Is it a sort of a natural symbiotic relationship that forms between a writer on staff and a particular talent, on-air talent? Do you just sort of gravitate to people in terms of sensibility? I mean, I know you're not assigned to somebody technically, but how does that happen or how did that happen for you that you were sort of working with certain people maybe more than others?
Well, that's a wonderful question, Paul. And it's the same reason that certain people become friends with other people and have a certain kind of relationship. Even though you like another person, you're maybe just on little different planes. You know, it's an affinity that you have and you go, wow, we're making each other laugh. Or, wow, I really like that person's sense of humor. So I would write with Dan Aykroyd because his sensibility was so different than mine. I'm this Jewish joke writer from Long Island, and Danny, you know, he can tell you how to take apart an engine, put it back together.
Right.
Okay, and I'm going, Jesus, you know. So the mixture of the two, we wrote a movie called Dragnet together. And I was living with Joe Friday, you know, for the draft that I did with him. And so I captured Joe Friday's voice. But Danny would come up with stuff that I would never be able to do. Years later, when I created It's Gary Shandling Show with Gary Shandling, Gary and I had the same sensibility. And any of these relationships, and I'm sure you've experienced it, is Yeah, your sensibilities are the same enough that you're attracted to each other and the same things make you laugh, but they're different enough that the alchemy of the two would come up with a product that neither one of you could have done alone.
That is that's such a great way of putting it. You know, I was writing on The Daily Show, we had quote unquote writing partners. So I and another writer who also was a stand-up shared an office. So we sort of wrote together, but we didn't. And it was perfect because you'd write your own thing and then maybe be stuck or say, you know what, just take a look at this, a different set of eyes. You know, we had a 10 in the morning to 1 in the afternoon. That was our writing deadline. Every day we had, it was like taking a final exam every day. It was like a nervous wreck. And then you hand them in and the jokes get picked, right? And so, because we would all get assigned a newspaper and we would go around in the morning and say, okay, what do you got in the New York Times? Oh, there's this story, this story. And then we get some video footage and we cull all that down to the 4, 5, or 6 jokes we're going to write that day for John at the desk. And you're right. When you bring to, it's got to be that right alchemy. You can't be so different that you can't sort of work together creatively, but different enough so that you're bringing something different to the table. That's such a really great way of putting it. And you know, one of the things I was curious about too is you've done all aspects of the business. You've done Broadway. You've done television. You've done movies. You've done books. Does one creative project inform the next? I know, you know, you came out of a movie and a TV show that didn't get reviews you were happy with, and you said it gave way to Bunny Bunny at your wife's suggestion. Would I have written it had I not had those two experiences? Maybe, but it came from a raw and very honest place. And I thought that was really a very artistic way of looking at it, that what happened to you before Bunny Bunny helped make Bunny Bunny what it is?
What's a wonderful question. So much of this is timing, and it's not only timing in the world, but it's your own timing. It's your own clock of your own emotionality, the ups and downs of whatever your life experiences are. And Gilda passed away. Her last TV performance was on his Carrie Shanlon show. And then when she died, as timing would have it, I wrote a movie that went straight into the toilet. Roger Ebert reviewed it and used the word hate in the review 14 times.
Jesus.
And I had created a show I let myself be talked into for the only first and only time in my career, did something that in my heart I knew was wrong. You know what I mean? You get an idea and, you know, it will either fail or succeed eventually based on timing, casting, this and that. But at least there's a nobility to the intent. You know what I mean? I believe in this. So the only time in my career, I let myself get talked into creating a TV show for Ryan O'Neal and Farrah Fawcett. And I had a writer's room that maybe had 11, 12 Emmys in it. And I had a supporting cast that had, two or three Tony Awards, but the show didn't work because Farrah and Ryan didn't work. Nobody found them funny. And so I now had two, let's say, to be kind, foul tips in a row. And, and this is after having so much success beforehand, you think you found the magic potion.
Yeah.
And I go, what the hell? I'm getting my ass whipped over here. And when my wife suggested Bunny Bunny, it's because I had just come off of this TV show, which I didn't have any of my own emotionality invested in it. It was a job. And she said, look, your best friend died a few years ago. You haven't cried yet. And so it became a catharsis. Bunny Bunny became a way of me revisiting Gilda one more time by recreating everything I can remember about the relationship. The whole book was written in dialogue. She talks, I talk. I didn't even want the formality of paragraphs, you know, or semicolons or whatever the hell. Yeah. I just wanted the words to touch each other again. And when I was done, I must say, when the people that I showed it to, and I didn't even mean it, write it to be published. I showed it to Carl Reiner. I showed it to Gary Shandling. I showed it to Mel Brooks. I showed it to Gene Wilder, who was married to Gilda. People I just thought might like the writing and be reminded of Gilda and me and Gilda. So in answer to your question, it was the honesty of it that I think turned people's heads, because it wasn't meant to, even though I ultimately said, okay, let's make a book out of it. Mm. Okay, let's make a play out of it. Okay. But the initial intent was a tribute. It was a personal love letter. And so there was an honesty to it. And the timing was as such where it became a bit of a panacea. It released something where I was able to get, okay, back on track.
Well, that all makes so much sense. And the honesty comes through. And it's what this is what's so great about the book is you get behind the artist, you a motivation in how they create. And, you know, thankfully, I'm glad North and Good Sports happened, because I don't know that you'd have a bunny the way you had it, because I get it. You really needed to do something true to you and raw and real, coming off of something that you didn't feel you were creatively, you know, really invested in. So I know you got to jump. We got to do another one of these. There's so much we got to talk about.
It's fun talking to you, man, but I'm glad we were able to do this.
Okay? Yeah.
But anytime, and we'll make it work.
We'll grab some dinner and get the wives together again and hang up with Frank and all that good stuff. So the book is,
I would love that.
An audio version of Laugh Lines, My Life, Helping Funny People Be Funnier, August 6th with Judd Apatow at the Stryker Center. And go on YouTube, Rock Bottom Remainders, hilarious video with amazing, amazing writers and performers. Thank you, buddy. Alan Zweibel, talk to you soon.
Take care, Paul. Thank you.
All right, there you go, Alan Zweibel. I'm going to have him on again. We're going to do a much longer conversation because he's got such great history, especially for, you know, being from the perspective of inside the offices that created some of the most brilliant comedy in the last 40 years. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Check out my YouTube channel, youtube.com/PaulMercurio, and follow me on the Insta, Twitter, Gram, Facebook stuff, @PaulMercurio. All right, guys, thanks.